You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it's 4 in the morning, Wednesday, November 11th, 2020. This show, as some of you know, was never really focused, in fact, has never focused on current events. I have no intention of talking about this farce of an election. Most of what needed to be said has already been said, and you know, the only thing I'll add, of course, is that it shows that monarchy is and has always been the superior form of state authority. Liberal democracy, democracy of any kind, is laughable. And what's happening today is really nothing new. So, anyway, as always, I ask of your continued financial assistance. Given everything that's going on, people like me are going to be under attack. As you know, I've been wiped out of Facebook. A lot of my stuff on YouTube has been eliminated. It doesn't make me special. I mean, it's been going on with a lot of people for a long time, including mainstream conservatives, which makes me laugh. For years, they try to placate the regime, and of course, they'll be treated the same way. The only way that this battle can continue is if people like me receive the proper financial support from people like you. You all know I've been at this for roughly 30 years, 25 years as a professional. And this show specifically first came out in, I believe, 2008. And people are willing to invest in something that's been around and has proven themselves or proven itself for years and years, not some flash in the pan. Well, it's very important, it's distasteful as it is to talk about. Unfortunately, I have a car payment now for the first time in a while. And the truth is that I need very little to function. And to some extent, we're going to be talking about the nature of work, income, and self-esteem. In the subject that is almost 50 years old. In fact, on the 9th of November, 1971, so 49 years ago, almost to the day, something happened in my hometown that really changed America and its psychology. Not only did it happen a few days after my birthday, I was born October 18th, 1971. This happened November 9th, 1971. It happened a few blocks from my house. And I'm talking about a topic that I've published on before, but never did a broadcast on, and that is the mass murder committed by John List in Westfield, New Jersey, in 1971. That day, he murdered his wife, his mother, and three children. He then went on the run and actually lived a successful, nondescript life for 17 years in both Colorado and Virginia. But worse than that, the number one hit, the American music charts, was Rod Stewart's Maggie May. That alone should show you the low that the U.S. had fallen in 1971. My theory is that that horrible song is one of the reasons that John List did what he did, but that's a, to say the least, a minority opinion. But there are other causes as well, not just Rod Stewart's insipid lyrics. John List became the first celebrity mass killer in modern America. Today, like everything gruesome, the serial killer, the mass murderer, of course, John was the latter, not the former, has almost become an entertainment category in and of itself. People are very interested in it, and not just the psychology, but the stories and the documentaries. There are tens of thousands of these that have been published in books and movies. It's almost an obsession. John List has been the subject of many biographies. 1993, Judgment Day, the John List story, starring Robert Blake. The Killer Next Door. There's about 5 books on him. And because I know so much about this, the man was well known in my neighborhood. I realized that these books and movies are almost entirely fictitious, to the point where they border on the unwatchable. The journalist, the historian, are today completely debased. Real cognition is banned, and the only thing that matters in these areas is conformity, mediocrity, and ideological cliches. Original research is really nowhere to be found within the academy or in the major newspapers. And as these jobs get fewer and fewer, those who have them have to become more and more sycophantic to maintain their tenuous hold on social respectability. But studying someone like John List, or Pol Pot for that matter, is to try to understand these men as they understood themselves. Of course, what happens in the postmodern West is that the regime puts a liberal veneer that interprets everything, usually, of course, creating a forced narrative that's nonsensical. Even if it doesn't fit, they ignore the evidence, they make up new bits of information, sometimes they cover it over with academic jargon and self-justification, and this is, nothing is more obnoxiously evident here than in the writing of the List murders. You know, once you're convicted of mass murder, you can't exactly sue for libel. You have no good name to defend. So those who are writing the documentaries and the books on these people, they're worried about market share. They're worried about readership. And most importantly, they're worried about the liberal agenda. I mean, we know what's happening right now on Facebook. They're losing millions of dollars to get rid of us. I'm on Gab, and I'm going to be on, I think it's Parler. A few of my friends have gone on it. Their servers are crashing because there's such a rush to sign up. But these people will go out of business before they reject liberalism and leftism. Huge markets are untouched because they're not politically correct. So anyone who wants to make a documentary or a hit show of some kind, when you're dealing with someone who's already been convicted or is dead, you can make up whatever you want and claim that this is based on actual events. These documentaries on these mass killers are sometimes almost entirely fiction. You can't look at someone like John List as a morality play. This goes for anybody, either in criminal justice or in politics. You see him as a human being. He didn't slaughter his family because he was insane. That's a mindless cop-out, and it says nothing. That's like saying something like, oh, he lost weight because he changed his eating habits. It's empty verbiage. Of course he did that. So why did John List kill everyone in his family that day? And of course, no one is saying this. No one is arguing this. In addition to the fact that Maggie May was number one song in the world at the time, he cracked due to the immense pressures of being a father in a society that was just beginning to destroy fatherhood and to destroy itself. It short-circuited his brain. He broke, so to speak. John List is an interesting case because it's a miniaturized version of what's happening and will happen more and more since 1971. By all accounts, John List was a good guy. His work ethic was very strong. He was very competent. He was an accountant. He lost his job at a bank in Central Jersey. And he lost his job because this was the beginning of this kind of consolidation in the face of greater competition and greater profits, of course. Those jobs were getting more and more scarce. And they were opting to hire younger, a female, less experienced CPAs for less money. The man was completely humiliated. He pretended to go to work every day. He just purchased a Victorian mansion in Westfield. Westfield was not a poor area, and was already very anxious about making the payments. List was a German patriarch of the old school. For him, as most men of that era, and most of the eras before it, being a man was constant pressure and responsibility. Everything was your fault. Everything is on your shoulders. Yes, his word was law, but at an immense price. Now, the one kernel of truth that's accepted by everyone is that once he lost his job as a CPA, List decided that rather than see his children as wards of the state, killed them all, including his wife and his aged mother, in what's probably the biggest overreaction in New Jersey history. But that's all that the documentaries agree on. That's where the factual analysis ends with them. No one could possibly defend this ludicrous overreaction. But these killings point to social trends and revolutionary politics that have not been dealt with in the pop culture nonsense of A&E biographies or these stupid cop shows. What was happening when I was born? What was happening in the fall of 1971? We saw the beginning of outsourcing. Japan and Western Europe were rebuilt with American funds, and we're now, of course, challenging American dominance. So to compensate, banks consolidated, and then capital fled the country seeking lower wages. Bringing women into the workforce was absolutely essential, and bringing in immigrants, both educated and uneducated, in the third world was an equally important priority. So now far more people are on the job market seeking fewer jobs. Labor costs fell dramatically. Today, actually, I wrote this article, it's on my Patreon. I wrote it a few years ago. Comparatively speaking, minimum wage today is at least 25% lower than in 1966 when the minimum wage was first instituted. There's a blog called My Budget 360, and there's an article reprinted on there called Comparing the Inflated Cost of Living Today from 1950 to 2014, How Declining Purchasing Power Has Hurt the Middle Class Since 1950. And reading something like this, you know, it's like listening to Dust in the Wind by Kansas for the first time. It's this intense depression. What's emphasized here, what has to be emphasized here, is back then, getting a job and supporting a family was almost guaranteed. Outside of mental illness or criminality, a man could easily support a family on a single salary. So when a man couldn't do this, he has to be either mentally deficient or a criminal. The cost of living was low, and our wants were far fewer. In the immediate post-war world, Liz took it for granted. Jobs were plentiful. Women and immigrants were not being bussed in en masse. Like today, more jobs existed at the time because it still included everything that was removed by computerization. Real unemployment was low, and the U.S. was producing goods to the entire world. Liz committed his crime precisely when wages for men began to fall under the weight of a much larger job pool and the resurgence of Japan and Europe. Their credit cards barely existed at the time. Debt was very low. And unfortunately, a man was defined by his economic and family success, and those were closely related, especially in his mind. Economically speaking, life was much easier in the 50s and 60s. A single wage earner at a mid-level job, white collar or blue collar, can get a nice house in an upper-class place like Westfield, New Jersey. In December 2013, the Economic Policy Institute showed pretty comprehensively that a single wage earner can support a family of four above the poverty line regardless of his line of work. I'm talking about in the 1950s and early 60s. And healthcare was a fringe benefit. So when John Liss lost his job that year, he saw himself as more than a loser. He wasn't a father either. He wasn't a man anymore. Capital was seen as an American conservative force against the communists at the time, and of course it was nothing of the kind. It was cosmopolitan, disloyal, and made immense profits trading with the USSR. Socially, it was very liberal, and capital sold out the working class that created it to save a few bucks on labor costs. Entire towns were disappearing so that stockholders received a slightly higher capital gain. Now, in 71, it was underway, but it wouldn't be fully manifest until later. John Liss lived in a world that he was not born into. It was becoming less and less sane. Like almost all men, he was forced to take full responsibility for a family, but the tools to do this were successfully eroding. And the problem is still the same today. The pressure on men remained tremendous, while the tools they needed to deal with that disappeared. The problem with John Liss was welfare, among other things. The Great Society was developed by Congress under LBJ in 1965, and really only came to prominence just a few years before the Liss killings. Nothing at the time was more humiliating than to have the state have to take care of your kids. There's still a stigma today, but it was nothing like back then. Within that culture, especially that Northern European patriarchal society, welfare was worse than death. It was a form of humiliation that most couldn't bear. This is why John pretended to go to work every day. He was far from alone in his, yes, but a demented belief that the kids would be better off dead than having to live with a failed, miserable father, which meant no father at all. The stigma at the time of welfare was crushing. Liss saw younger men and women doing better than he was. They were in jobs less useful, with a far inferior work ethic. He saw the country being torn apart, while he had to foot the bill. And something that no one ever mentioned in all the books on John Liss, he was in World War II. He had to deal with the fact that he fought on the wrong side, killing fellow Germans so that the USA could profit from the USSR and Stalin could spread his gulag to Central Europe. Violent war protesters were granted amnesty, major banks traded with the Reds, but he was jobless. 1971, the left was tearing society apart. These are the people now in full control of the press. Groups like the Jewish Defense League, the Puerto Rican Movement, up until very recently, were the two most violent terror groups in America, according to the FBI. Have you ever heard of Sam Melville? No, you haven't. He set off more than 100 bombs between August and November of 1969 in Manhattan. Why has no one heard of him? This is what Time Magazine says in an article on 2016. Now they're talking about the Weather Underground. But those attacks began 3 months later, 1971, protest bombings had spread across the country. In a single 18-month period during 1971 and 72, the FBI counted an amazing 2,500 bombings on American soil, almost five a day. Because they were detonated late at night, few caused serious injury, leading to a kind of grudging public acceptance. The deadliest underground attack of the decade killed four people in the January 1975 bombing of a Wall Street restaurant. News accounts rarely carried any expression or indication of public outrage. Now, while the numbers are very high, certainly far more were killed and injured, but Time magazine isn't about to talk about that. 2,500 bombings on American soil, and yet terrorism was not considered a major public threat by the ruling class of the day. The press refused to depict any outrage because the press was a part of it. The media was never an unbiased news source. That's not their purpose. The Third World Liberation Front, a group that even specialists in political science have never heard of, set off 70 bombs between 1974 and 1978 on the West Coast. No public outrage was ever registered. The Puerto Rican separatists alone killed hundreds of Americans and a deliberately covered up terror campaign in the 70s and 80s. In 1975, one of these groups killed four and wounded almost 100 when they bombed the Francis Tavern in Manhattan. In 1979, they shot up a U.S. Navy bus, killing four sailors. It made front page news of the New York Times and was immediately forgotten. The article neglected to mention that this group was financed by Castro. In 1974, the SLA killed six in Los Angeles with the Hearst kidnapping. Still no outrage. American cities burned nightly. The left remained ascendant. No outrage. No Department of Homeland Security, no Patriot Act. And Time magazine lies through its teeth when it says that only four people were killed. They know that that's not true. So when you're talking about someone like John List and many others who broke mentally, maybe didn't kill people around them, but did other antisocial things at the time, aren't understood because the A&E biography and the History Channel, that aren't nothing more than propaganda, they have no idea the context of these killings. They wouldn't admit it anyway. First, they didn't grasp the pressure of the old school placed on the heads of family. Now, the fact, number two, John List was a more or less religious man, a Lutheran, and they loved to stress the religious concerns, but those were quite secondary to List's mind. And third, the producers of these stupid shows don't understand, won't want to, simply refuse to understand what was happening in the early 70s relative to American capitalism and the ideological baggage it created. So, in the movies like Judgment Day, The Killer Next Door, they try to argue that it was his strictly Lutheran background that led to the slaughter of his family. From A&E, the quote is, "He was a deeply repressed man." Watching the A&E story on him was terrifying. Most of the material was completely invented. It was just based on the story. It had nothing to do with it. Few have access to the actual facts, and List was in no position to protest. So naturally, the tendency of the media was to sensationalize and to promote a stale corporate liberalism. A&E invented the story that he saw his family as a burden and, quote, resented that his wife tricked him into marriage. This is entirely made up. The truth is that they loathe the value system List accepted. From prison, John List said, "I was ashamed." That was the key sentence in his rationalization for his killings. They said that he was going from job to job. That's not true either. A&E said that. He was very stable. Now, when he killed his family, he went on the run. And on the run, he was very successful, working as a CPA under an assumed name in Denver for much of that time. Before our identities were computerized, you could actually get away with that. He didn't even try to disguise his appearance. Like it or not, men, these healthy men, are genetically programmed to be the main leader, protector, and supporter of the family. And of course, these are the qualities that women seek in men. Strength, confidence, a good future. These are aphrodisiacs. There, women will respect a man, when that respect is lost, the mental results are disastrous. At the time, women didn't really need to make anything of themselves. If they were pretty, you got what you need. I mean, how often do you see gorgeous women who are poor? In the culture of the day, the only thing maybe more humiliating than being on welfare was having your wife work because you couldn't. Many men chose suicide rather than live this way, but don't hold your breath for a documentary on the subject. When List committed his killings, all this was just getting started. It should be noted that American suicide rates sharply spiked starting in 1968. From 68 to 75, the suicide rate, adjusted for changing age stratification, went from 11 per 100,000 to almost 13. Now, on this measure, 2 points is a very large change that cries out for an explanation. And, of course, most of those are men. Men kill themselves, especially white men kill themselves in far greater numbers than women. And this is no accident, according to the WHO. List was seeing himself as superfluous. And that was not an accident either. Easy divorce was becoming the law of the land. Unions were a thing of the past. The court system took over and served as a vanguard of social revolution. Non-whites were mobilized by capital to ensure that white nationals never spoke out. The non-white population, of course, exploded. Even reason was under siege. John List's killings of his family was a radical and twisted internalization of this crisis. It was a crisis of legitimacy. Everything that List had suffered for was under attack. And this era, you had a massive spike in divorce rates. The media began defining the perfect man and the perfect woman on TV. It was the world of the rich and famous, routinely contrasted to the viewer's life. Drug use and crime were sharply rising. And unfortunately, men of List's era were pretty much unaware of the forces that were arrayed against them. Alejandro Ruiz wrote in the journal called Dollars and Cents. He said, in the 1970s, the U.S. position as the unchallenged colossus of the capitalist world was suddenly threatened from multiple directions. Rising international competition, spiking energy prices, declining productivity and profitability, and then soaring inflation and unemployment. The U.S. trade deficit crept up in the course of the 1960s, and government deficits emerged late in the decade and persisted through the 1970s. Declining international confidence in the dollar led to the depletion of gold reserves as international holders of dollars demanded redemption of their dollars for gold. And the Nixon administration ended the fixed rate convertibility of the dollar for gold. Inflation picked up in the late 60s, going from 3% in 66 to 6% in 71. They may not look high now, but they were alarming at the time, coming on the heels of a 7-year period in which the annual inflation rate never exceeded 1.5%. The important thing here to understand is that these realities shifted the public perception. The figures above translated into men no longer being able to provide entirely for their families, and of course, the increase in female employment. That means the immense pressures on the heads of household were getting worse and more desperate. Now, of course, it's true that they didn't slaughter their families at the protest here, but that is necessary to understand the mentality of the day. I should note, of course, that John died of pneumonia in 2008. He was the first person to be apprehended by the use of the software designed to age someone. You see it all the time now, but at the time they made a model of what he would look like, you know, almost 20 years into the future from the last known picture of the guy. It was America's Most Wanted for the very first time. It was a brand new show, and it made its reputation on being instrumental in getting List. And understand the argument here. You know, sometimes people are so stupid, they'll listen to something like this and they'll go, oh my God, what is he arguing? He must mean that the American dominance is under attack and feminism, therefore I got to kill my family. I mean, can you imagine? That's obviously not what I'm arguing, but people are so simplistic, that's usually what they read into this. I'm talking about a gestalt. I'm talking about the culture at the time, how men were perceived, and now, quite explicitly, they're being told that they are superfluous, that their virtues no longer matter, and yet they still have the drive to perform as true patriarchs without having the economic resources or the cultural foundation. Needless to say, no one has ever mentioned, as I said already, the fact that he was in World War II fighting against his own German people. If it were Vietnam, of course they'd bring it up, but not in this case. I don't understand my interest in this. You know, my parents, they had mutual friends, that we lived a few blocks from each other. They to some extent, but my father opened up his business in 1966, a few blocks away. I'm from Clark, he's from Westfield, but they're right next to each other. And so I do know things that others don't in this respect. And one of the problems here is, you know, he wrote a letter to his pastor after the deed was done. And it's difficult. You can't get your hands on it. And it's difficult because reading it would destroy the whole PC narrative that the regime had created. Only the New York Times printed the letter in full. They waited from 1971 to 1990 to print it. That means the letter, the one thing that expressed his mentality at the time, was kept from the public eye. And there was good reason for this. Now, the letter's to a pastor, so of course it's going to be vaguely religious. A&E documentary said that the letter was littered with biblical quotations. It doesn't contain a single one. His reasons for his acts were entirely modern and secular. This is what List says in his letter to his pastor after the killings. I know that what has been done is wrong from all that I've been taught, and that any reason that I might give will not make it right. But you're the one person that I know, while not condoning this, would at least possibly understand why I felt I had to do this. Number one, I wasn't earning anywhere near enough to support us. Everything I tried seemed to fall to pieces. True, we could have gone bankrupt and maybe gone on welfare. Two, but that brings me to my next point. Knowing the type of location that one would have to live in, plus the environment for the children, plus the effect on them knowing that they were on welfare, was more than I thought they could and should endure. I know that they were willing to cut back, but this involved a lot more than that. Three, with Pat being so determined to get into acting, I was also fearful as to what might do to her continuing to be a Christian. I'm sure it would not have helped. That was reprinted in the New York Times in 1990. And that was a letter he wrote after the murder explaining what he did. Now, the letter is much longer than that, of course, but that's the heart of it. His entire rationale was that living with a failed father is not life for kids. A failed father isn't a father. In his mind, these children would grow up knowing that they were social outcasts, wards of the state, their father a public joke, and emasculated. The traditional role of the father is essential for any understanding of this. In one of the greatest legal documents of Western history, Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England, this is what he says. This was published between 1765 and 1769. This is what it says. First, of protecting his children from the snares of artful and designing persons, and next, of settling them properly in life by preventing the ill consequences of too early and precipitate marriages. A father has no other power over his son's estate than as his trustee or guardian. For though he may receive the profits during the child's minority, yet he must account for them when he comes of age. He may indeed have the benefit of his children's labor while they live with him and are maintained by him, but this is no more than he is entitled to from his apprentices and servants. The legal power of a father, the power of a father, I say, over the persons of his children ceases at the age of 21. For they are then enfranchised by arriving at years of differentiation, or that point where the law had established when the empire of the father gives place to the empire of reason. Now, there's probably no authority in the Western legal tradition more important than that. This defined, kind of collected the traditional understanding of fatherhood that to some extent still exists. It expresses the duties of fathers precisely in the way that John List understood them. Now, the era in which those commentaries were written were far more rational than this one, and no father of a family was out of work for long, and the cost of living was far lower. Currencies were controlled by the state until fairly recently, and because of this, they retained their value. I stated that the inflation rate was, I think, never more than 1.5% for years and years and years, because even though the U.S. currency wasn't under state control at the time, you didn't have the modern buccaneer, postmodern capitalist ideology. In the U.S., manufacturing and all its complementary fields was a powerful provider of employment, really until the late 70s. But note the phrase, when the empire of the father gives place to the empire of reason. That means the father's role is to act as the yet undeveloped reason for his children. The assumption that the father will be the primary protector and breadwinner of the home is taken for granted. These commentaries speak of bastards, or children without fathers. That was a humiliating vantage point for later development, as an absent father also includes one that can't support the family financially. A deadbeat dad, so to speak, isn't just one that refuses to support the family, but cannot support the family. It's like he never existed. In other words, the tradition of Western Europe, and really much of the world, is that a failed father is not a father at all, despite the facts of biology. It's hard to put yourself in the mind of the era where a rational, high school educated man could get a good job, really in any field, and as I've already shown, support a family above the poverty line and sometimes substantially above the poverty line. So if you weren't doing that, there was something wrong with you. Today's a different story. But I mentioned his veteran status in World War II. John List was told, as a proud German Lutheran, that the Renaissance of Germany after World War I was the world's greatest evil, and therefore the only solution in the resurrection of the German people was to slaughter them. But even as early as 71, the Lists of the world were starting to notice they fought on the wrong side. The victory of Stalin ensured that the Korean and Vietnam Wars were going to happen. John List participated in the mass slaughter of his own people. Somehow, that made him a hero. Now, this broadcast and the paper that this is based on is the very first to note this obvious connection in List's mind. I mean, List killed family members overseas in order to see his job outsourced, non-whites attack his society with impunity, and the drug culture to take over where religion, folk tradition, and national custom had existed before. There was one man who stood against these things, and List had been told that he was evil incarnate. This was a revolution that was happening in the West at the time. The Archie Bunkers of the world also had to contend with this level of conceptual conflict that the weaker minds couldn't fathom. The regime, then and now, has one fear, that there would be a leader to take the place, a leader to mobilize the Archie Bunkers of the U.S. and connect the dots for them. List was just another Archie Bunker, but he was more educated and more cultured. But in 71, he wasn't able to connect the dots that would show that the destruction of Hitler and the nationalist movement in Europe is what led to the very revolution that had the family in tatters and his life even worse. John List killed his family because his mind had short-circuited. The world that he was raised in was slowly being destroyed. Capitalism shifted the country into a cosmopolitan liberal society, and internationalized production was necessary to maintain competitiveness. This is why he lost his job. Most of the time, of course, it failed. America was being hollowed out as the regime abandoned the men who created her industrial greatness in the first place, to save a few bucks. This was the beginning of the era where men and fathers were denigrated as superfluous, as ignorant. I mean, Archie Bunker alone is evidence of that. You know, people like Homer Simpson later on reflects this mentality. Thousands of these cultural tropes can be cited. But the responsibilities and social pressure to be a success still remain, despite that context. Immigration is capitalism's means of replacing the white male. The rage building up inside of the American male, especially the white male, has reached dangerous levels. And the slightest spark might set it off. Now, I'm not going to speak very much about the election, as I said, but it should be noted that our people are in the streets in large numbers. Understand the argument here. The argument here is that John List, of course, was an extreme and twisted case of this phenomenon. The humiliations of the white man, especially the white male father, has become so intense and so nonstop that it's not going to take much to set that tinder alight. The regime simply doesn't have the conceptual means to understand it. And we all know that already, I can't remember the website, I think it's Trump Accountability or something like that, they are compiling a list of names of Trump supporters, and I can only imagine is to round them up, either metaphorically or literally, and destroy them. Again, either metaphorically or literally. Now, this is no surprise. None of this is any surprise. The only thing that makes this different is the fact the regime is so blatant about it. So let's be clear. The argument that I just made interprets John List killing his family as, for lack of a better phrase, a short circuit in his brain. But where did it come from? No one saw this coming. John List was a very normal guy. He was pretty strict, but really no more so than the typical father of the day. There was nothing odd about him relative to, you know, your typical son of German immigrants who was successful. 1971 was the very beginning of the revolution. Whether it be in economics, whether it be in race relations, gender relations, everything to drive the white male out of the public sphere with the notion that they were simply getting too much money. To be competitive means that labor costs are going to have to fall. And one of the ways to do that is outsourcing goods, destroying national borders, and to make it easier, simply bring the third world to America, rather than bring the Americans to the third world. Whenever you have more of something, so long as the demand remains the same, it's going to become much cheaper. That's the whole point of feminism, whether it be Stalin's version or the modern American version. That's the point of immigration. The idea is to, as I've said on this show, really, I think just last week or 2 weeks ago, to humiliate the white male as really the only source of counter-revolution. Something else I want to mention, and it's very similar here, and just another example of what's happening around us that many of you have missed. In terms of jury trials, I'm talking about a case, Pina Rodriguez versus Colorado. I don't think many of our people have noted this. In 2007, Miguel Rodriguez, Pina Rodriguez, sexually assaulted several teenagers who later identified him to police. It was an easy case, and there was no question as to the veracity of the teens. He was convicted, but the defense discovered a loophole to set him free. A juror made comments that were vaguely negative toward Mexicans, and that was sufficient to get him a new trial. Pina versus State of Colorado started on March 6, 2007. A juror was impeached because he thought Hispanic men treated women badly. It was simply a reference to machismo, or bravado. The court concluded that because of this belief, the juror should have been eliminated and the trial was thus unfair. The court said, where a juror makes a clear statement indicating that he or she relied on racial stereotypes or animus to convict a criminal defendant, the Sixth Amendment requires that the no impeachment rule give way in order to permit the trial court to consider the evidence of the juror's statement and any resulting denial of the jury trial guarantee. The logic is laughably faulty, and therefore the decision is not based on rational premises. No one here said or implied that the juror relied on stereotypes. It also assumes stereotypes are false. But the judge knows this. Therefore, the decision came by force some other direction. The decision says this. According to two jurors, H.C., this is how they identified him, told the other jurors that he believed the defendant was guilty because in H.C.'s experience as an ex-law enforcement officer, Mexican men had a bravado that caused them to believe they can do whatever they wanted with women. End quote. So the decision then, having quoted that, said, the unmistakable principle underlying these precedents is that discrimination on the basis of race, odious in all respects, is especially pernicious in the administration of justice. However, the statement referenced is mostly true and was uttered from the experience of a law enforcement officer in the crime-ridden Hispanic community. So there's a knowing disconnect between the court's rhetoric and the facts that the court itself states. It's not just poor legal rhetoric, it's imposed by force. The court says, it's one thing to accuse a fellow juror of having a personal experience that improperly influences her consideration for the case. It's quite another to call her a bigot. That's one of the stranger comments in this Orwellian decision. Justice Kennedy, who wrote this, is aware that bigotry is not the issue, an extremely rare phenomenon. The facts of the case show that the offending juror's statement to be reasonable, factually based, cannot be bigotry, which by definition has no reason behind it. The offending juror also stated that Pina's alibi witness couldn't be trusted because he was an illegal immigrant. That also necessitated a new trial. But the argument was a reasonable one. Since the witness was a criminal himself, he's not the best source of information. But because the witness was Hispanic, this fact now has to be ignored by juries under threat of automatic acquittal. Criminality, of course, is important for rejecting witness credibility, but that only works today if the witness is white. So the court has effectively stated that certain important, essential facts cannot be stated in jury rooms if they conflict with the official ideology. This is what the court says. This is the level of hyperbole here. The nation must continue to make strides to overcome race-based discrimination. The progress that has already been made underlies the court's insistence that blatant racial prejudice is antithetical to the functioning of the jury system and must be confronted in egregious cases like this one, despite the general bar of the no impeachment rule. Given what the offending statements were, that comment doesn't make any sense. It doesn't even refer to it. Prejudice is irrelevant. It means prejudgment or judgment without regard to facts or experience. Yet that was the opposite of what was happening here. The juror did have experience with Hispanics in precisely the legal case that the case demanded. There was no racial prejudice here whatsoever. And I began wondering about the Pina case, and I remember back in 2016, the BBC ran a story romanticizing the feminists in Mexico, condemning the very same concept of machismo mentioned in the comment above. Marisol Reyes, the psychologist of the Mexico State Council for Women, said in typical feminist rhetoric that machismo is a hegemonic model of masculinity in Mexico. The man who shouts, who has to hit people to show his power, there is machismo in Mexico. Now, that's a well-known fact. It's an issue all over Mexico, as this documentary and article laid out. So well-known facts about Mexican males in this context is now illegal to mention in jury deliberations. In 2012, a major study showed that violence makes Mexico one of the worst places for a woman to live in the G12. And the left in Mexico is talking about this all the time. showing Resnick and Miles' 1996 paper show empirically the consequences of a Mexican machismo. For better or for worse, I'm not supporting the feminist line here, but from the court's point of view, claiming that this former policeman was motivated by insane and psychotic racial hatred for mentioning this, a basic fact, shows you that now the criminal justice system can't function. The point is that non-white defendants will be set free, and defense attorneys are just going to go through jury deliberations hoping to find a comment like this, a slightly negative assessment, true or otherwise, of the non-white group is enough for an acquittal, or at the very least, a new trial. So you have a situation where 90% of all gang members are non-whites, and about Hispanics are about half of that. Okay, National Gang Center, the Bureau of Justice, says about 80% of all violent criminal acts are by gang members. Yet in a gang violence case, to mention that fact will lead to the defendant going free, which is now strong evidence, and there's always been mounting evidence, that these gangs are being financed by certain factions in the U.S. government and the oligarchy. And they're essentially protecting their investments here. So the decision in this case, and I'm connecting it in a very vague way with the List case, this is the stuff that people saw coming as early as 71. The use of non-whites to break down, to dissolve the society that existed prior to this, which was largely Northern European and white. The decision here is nonsense. And the verbiage is so bad, it has to be forced. This is the Supreme Court we're talking about here. Supreme Court is usually wrong, but they usually don't make errors that blatantly awful. To believe that the court is really arguing that a reasoned comment about machismo is identical to a rational discrimination based exclusively on appearance is simply beyond credibility. Even Clarence Thomas wrote the dissent to this, but it's a suspicious dissent because it ignores all the relevant issues of fact and logic. So the story now is, after the Pena case, non-white criminals otherwise convicted of their crimes will now have lawyers combing through jury deliberations seeking offending statements that might be seen as accepting race and ethnicity as actual human categories. This will have to be the case, since no defense lawyer will leave this stone unturned in the face of a conviction. Which means now there's going to be a court reporter present for all jury discussions. If that's not the case, then how could a fair trial be assured, according to the new Supreme Court definition? How could the public know that jurors reasoned appropriately? So my point, I think, is very clear. Number one, in the John List case, you're talking about a man who snapped at the very beginning of the revolution, where the society that he was born and raised in was deliberately being broken down by the people who just fired him from his job. I'm not even arguing that ideological considerations mattered. There's no evidence of that. But in some sense, the Archie Bunkers of the era were aware that they're being replaced. They want too much money. And the oligarchy wants more malleable people, whether at home or abroad, or at the very least, wants to bring in enough groups so that they'll begin fighting each other and they could divide one and rule the rest, with only one group, as we all know, remaining very cohesive. And number two, one particular manifestation of this, and it's especially important with the riots that have gone on and will continue to go on no matter what happens, they'll be used as a weapon whenever something goes wrong. The Pena case means now, even if a non-white is convicted, there's a good chance that if a juror says something recognizing the very existence of race, and the example I just gave you in that Supreme Court case, Pena Rodriguez versus Colorado, it was an intelligent, reasoned response that makes a lot of sense, and that even the left accepts in Mexico. That was sufficient. to set the guy free. Of course, this only happens for non-whites. Whites do not have that same treatment. If you remember when the riots first broke out over this make-believe George Floyd case, you had violent prisoners being released from prison for obviously no good reason. The official reasoning didn't make any sense. You want to isolate someone, prison's where you go. And these prisoners are not susceptible to COVID anyway. They're not gonna drop dead. They're healthy males. It's not going to happen. They're trying to ban every kind of weaponry, shutting down gun shops. Ammunition has been taken off the shelves of Walmart, etc. And number three, of course, every method of media provocation is being created to constantly inflame non-whites against whites in general. This irrational Dionysian insanity. Finally, now, the Pena case makes it almost impossible to prosecute these people. And that's beyond the fact that a white policeman simply now can't function in American society. Whenever you see something so blatantly irrational, like trying to deny that the election was based on fraud, it's so easy to prove otherwise. They're not denying it because they literally can't see it. No, they're well aware of it. They're well aware of the irrationality here and how stupid this court decision is. But the reasoning doesn't even connect to anything. No, that's not the issue. Their agenda is far deeper than that. This is simply one method out of many to make sure that non-whites can do whatever they want and policemen can't do anything about it. And even if they do something about it, the courts will set them free. But of course, at least we saved Europe from Hitler.